And good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frains at the controls. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here on the program on a Monday for their show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that we have someone here who is more of a generalist. We do have people who are specialists from time to time throughout the year. But the idea is to have someone who can respond to a variety of questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice. So if you have a question, could be for yourself, could be for someone in your family, could be one of your kids, could be your partner, you know, whatever. If you have healthcare questions, give us a call. And he will do his best to help you out. Obviously, we can't diagnose over the phone. That's the one limitation. But it might be a place to start. And if you have some basic questions, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Any point here, you can give us a call. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, David. Good to be back.
We were just talking about how I think it was the last time you were here, and I guess that would have been in August, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that at that point we talked about heat stress. And,
right.
And here we were saying, now,
and
on
I was,
October...
I was anticipating that we'd be talking about the winter flu season, but with 90-degree weather, it's a little hard to imagine that that's right around the corner.
We were just talking about, in fact, that there... I know people heard about this, that yesterday was the running of the Chicago Marathon, and there were a lot of people who got sick because of the heat, and there was, in fact, one fatality. Someone actually died because the conditions were that bad. Now, I think we're finally expecting there's going to be one more hot day today, and then we're getting into more seasonable temperatures. I don't know if it's worth one more time saying, hey, these are the symptoms of heat stress, and if you're feeling like this, you better take some action because it's potentially you really can be very harmful.
Right, especially vigorous physical activity like they were doing, obviously with the marathon. It's extremely important to stay adequately hydrated to replace any electrolytes, the sodium potassium that's lost when we sweat under those kind of circumstances. But that's really kind of an unusual situation with, you know, obviously running 26 miles. But it can, in fact, occur to anyone in the proper circumstances. So if the weather's going to be like this, it still pays to pay attention.
Yeah. And probably even, you know, people who are working around the house, doing yard work, cutting the grass, all those sorts of things that, you know, we do in the summertime that you might really not think about it very much, but we still have the same concern about being sure that you don't get overexposed, overworked, dry, dehydrated. You know, you want to make sure that you're drinking plenty of water and take some breaks. And
I think that's the key part there. If you can take what you're going to do and break it up, and you know, every hour or so go back in the house if it's air conditioned, get your fluids, rest a few minutes, and then go back out and work again. I think it's oftentimes when people just keep going and then just don't quite realize that they're really getting behind on their fluids, they're overexerting themselves. And unfortunately, if you really do start to suffer from heat exhaustion, it does in fact affect your mental faculties, and sometimes you're not quite really aware that things are getting as bad as they are.
Yeah.
So taking the break and making sure that you don't get to that point is probably best.
Right. Well, in terms of seasonal things, yes, I guess about at this time we would be just starting maybe to talk about the fact that flu season's coming.
And normally we would start with the flu shots at the end of this month. And I believe some of the organized flu clinics will be starting up the last week of October.
Okay. And in past years, people will remember there were some concerns about was there enough vaccine? It was available when it was needed? And I guess I haven't read anything this year, certainly nothing so far, raising questions about would there be enough?
Right now, there doesn't appear to be any shortage of the actual flu vaccine by injection. If you remember, when there was a shortage, there was an alternative product called Flu Mist, which was a nasal spray that could be used instead of the flu shot. So between the two of those, everyone who sort of wants to or should get a immunization against influenza should be able to get that this year.
And who you're recommending should have the shot?
Well, they keep expanding the recommended patient target populations, and basically it's anybody who wants one, but in particular, individuals over the age of 65 are still definitely recommended. Anyone who has chronic heart or lung disease or any other significant chronic medical condition, oftentimes the bad diabetics fall into this category. But the other groups that have recently been added are pregnant women, and they are, in fact, recommended to get a flu shot in the fall, even if they are pregnant. The flu shot itself is a dead virus, so you're not going to transmit any illness to either mom or the baby. And then the other group is the pediatric age group. Infants from 6 months of age up through children 5 years of age are all in the recommended group for influenza vaccination, and also the individuals in the households that contain children from 6 months to 5 years of age are also recommended to be immunized.
Okay, very good. Well, we have a caller here to start us off. Someone who was in Champaign. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a theoretical question to ask. If they can develop a vaccine for West Nile virus for horses, why can't they do it for people?
It's an excellent question, and I'm afraid I don't have the technical expertise to answer that. My suspicion is that there probably isn't any laboratory reason why you couldn't, but there probably is an extremely limited market for the vaccine, in that the vast majority of the population is not affected by it. A fairly large number of people who do get bitten by infected mosquitoes, when they become ill, have a mild, self-limited, again, sort of viral kind of illness. And it's really only the exceptional patient who ends up so sick that they get to the hospital and actually get tested for West Nile. So my suspicion is that there's probably not a whole lot of economic incentive to develop that.
Well, I can understand that. But now I have another question on the same subject. If one has West Nile virus, you know, has gone through that, it's run their system, does that make them immune for future, problems?
In the vast majority of cases with many viral illnesses, a one-time exposure probably does not confer lifelong immunity. Your body will, in fact, produce an antibody response to most illnesses, but in a large number of cases, especially with viral illnesses, that's a very short-lived response and does not confer permanent immunity.
So that's the reason we get that's one of the reasons we get a flu vaccine
every year. Exactly.
And okay, you've answered my questions. Thank you.
Okay.
It's also the reason why you can get a cold more than once. There are multiple different cold viruses, some of which are similar, but coming down with one doesn't necessarily protect you from either getting that one or similar ones again in the future.
So if we went out there and we just got together a random sample of people, and we could do a blood test and we could find out how many of those people had been exposed to West Nile, would there be some kind of marker you could tell?
Yes, but you would probably have to test them soon after their exposure. And so to really do a study, you would probably have to get a bunch of people, deliberately expose them to the virus, and then do the test. Because otherwise, you're just going to get a random sample of the population, some of whom, the vast majority of whom, have not been exposed. Yeah. So there's nothing that you're going to find. And only a few would have been exposed recently enough that you'd actually be able to pick up anything.
So that's, I guess, what I'm wondering is, how many people might have been bitten by a mosquito that was carrying the virus and might have not felt good for a day or two, but then it went away, and who never really would have thought, the idea that they would have had West Nile
wouldn't even enter their mind.
Exactly.
And that's probably the overwhelming majority of cases that do occur, and they simply don't come to light officially, so there's no specific testing that's done on those folks. So that part of the equation, we don't have a number to plug in there, but in all likelihood, there are probably thousands of people who've been exposed for every patient who ends up in the hospital who then gets tested and turns out to be positive. Mm-hmm.
And for those people, there are a small number of fatalities. Are those people who are already maybe not in good health or immunocompromised or in some way sort of vulnerable?
It's elderly people with lots of other comorbidities. And yes, it's unusual to see an otherwise vigorous, active person succumb to that.
Our guest here this morning on Focus 580 in this hour is Dr. Jeff Swearengin. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic. He is here every other month for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have questions, you're welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have someone here to talk with in Mattoon, line 4.
Good morning.
Hello? Yes.
Maybe you covered this. I got in a little late, but I've got a problem with eggs, and the doctor tells me I can't take the flu shot, which I haven't for years, and I thought they were going to change it so that people who are allergic to eggs can take it.
We actually haven't discussed it this time, but I believe it's come up before, and the manufacturing process for producing the flu vaccine occurs with basically incubating the virus and letting it grow inside eggs. And that's just the way it's always been done. Unfortunately, then there is a little bit of egg protein contained in the finished product, and people who do in fact have significant allergies to egg are encouraged not to get the flu shot. What I can't right off the top of my head tell you is whether the flu mist would have the same concern or not. And that would be something to check with one of the references related to the particular product. And if, in fact, there's no warning regarding egg allergies for the flu mist, that would be a perfectly reasonable way for you to be immunized against influenza. The other way in which you can be protected is the general concept of what the veterinarians are already familiar with, which is called herd immunity. If you're immunizing your herd of cattle against a particular illness or disease, you in fact don't really have to immunize all of them. Basically, the critical mass is about 80%. And what then happens is that for every, in this case, animal in the herd that's not immunized, they're essentially surrounded by four cattle who are immunized. And consequently, it reduces significantly the opportunity for that unimmunized animal to then contract the illness. And the same thing's true in immunizations for people, whether it's children or adults. If you immunize a large enough group, but not 100%, you can essentially eliminate the illness because there isn't a whole series of individuals who can then spread the illness anymore, and even then the unimmunized ones are relatively protected simply because they're surrounded by people who are immunized. So in your particular case, if everyone around you has a flu shot, it's highly unlikely that you'll have the opportunity to contract it. And that forms the basic recommendation for household contacts of children. You know, children who are between 6 months and 5 years of age may in fact be at home and not likely to be exposed to flu, but if their siblings who are in school or their parents who are at work bring the illness home, then they themselves can contract it, and at their age, it's much more likely to be a more serious illness. So basically, immunizing the contacts of the group that you're wanting to protect is another way of ensuring immunity.
I've been able to get pneumonia shots from time to time, and I thought that there was some effort being made to make the flu shot in a different way, but I guess there's nothing to that story.
I'm not aware that there's been any significant change in the manufacturing process. So at this point, I'm not aware of that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. And here I'm looking at some information about the flu mist, and it looks like it's made in the same way. So
same way.
You can't, if you have the egg problem, you can't
use it.
You can't use it either.
Well, encourage all your friends and family. Everyone you know to be immunized. Eh?
Next, someone in Savoy. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with buildup of earwax. And it's happened a couple of times where I've had my ears flushed, and there was a lot of wax there, which results in me not being able to hear very well. Is there any way that I can prevent that happening?
Actually, yes. You have described, I would say, one of the more common problems, fortunately not usually very serious until the wax accumulates enough that you can't hear. But there are some over-the-counter drops that you can buy in your pharmacy that are specifically to help soften earwax. Normally, earwax is sort of a soft, gel-like consistency that when you take your bath or your shower will simply flow out of the ear canal. You might get a little bit on your fingertip, you know, if you wash through your ear there. And as long as the wax is kept fairly soft and pliable, it will generally come out on its own. And then in situations where either people make so much of it that it's accumulating quickly or it dries out, then the remaining wax simply piles up against it, and after a while it will simply occlude the little tunnel that your ear canal is. So the earwax softening drops can be used on a, you know, 2-3 times a week kind of basis, simply to keep the wax soft, and as long as it comes out a little bit at a time all the time, it won't accumulate anymore, and you shouldn't have that problem.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next is Urbana here. We'll talk with someone else. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question about allergies. I have a 14-year-old boy who has had seasonal allergies, the ragweed and all that kind of stuff. Just like his dad. We never had him tested, just used Claritin and all that. This summer, the pediatrician did want to at least do the blood test for the allergies. So we did that, got the sheet back saying molds, grasses, all that stuff. No big surprise. Referred us to an allergist who wanted to put him on Allegra and Nasonex, which we did. And now the allergist wants us to do the skin test and talking about shots. And my feeling is, over-the-counter is pretty much taking care of it. What's the wisdom in getting involved in the whole shots and that regime?
Okay. Point up an extremely common problem, at least in East Central Illinois, where seasonal allergies, especially this time of year, are especially bad. Usually from sort of mid-August until the first hard freeze, we have what people commonly refer to as hay fever season. But between the naturally occurring plants that grow here and then the agricultural activity with the farmers kicking up corn and beans and dust and stuff into the air, this is a particularly problematic time. You described the two most common treatments for seasonal allergies, and that's an oral antihistamine. You mentioned Claritin, Allegra, Zyrtec. They're over-the-counter antihistamines, Benadryl, Clotrimeton, those sorts of things. And then the second part is the steroid nasal spray. Nasonex, Nasacort, Flonase, Rhinocort, there's, again, a whole variety of them. But the combination of an oral antihistamine and a nasal steroid is probably the most effective and most commonly used method of treating seasonal allergies. We will then, assuming that you can't avoid what it is that you're allergic to, the ideal treatment is to stay away from whatever it is you're allergic to. Unfortunately, here in East Central Illinois, it's what we're breathing, and that's kind of tough to avoid. So the next step, if symptoms are not well controlled, if somebody says, you know, my allergies are making me miserable, or especially in kids, a fairly common problem is their allergies set off their asthma. So if we have somebody with really, really bad asthma that's getting triggered by their allergies and their allergies aren't well controlled despite antihistamines and nasal steroids, the next step is primarily allergy injections. You would do the skin test to identify exactly which allergens are a problem so that you can produce the serum that you're going to give the shots with.
But we haven't had any asthma, never, no history of it, never anything. And so that's, to me, that's saying we're not quite that, to that degree.
And how does your son feel his symptoms are? Well,
he thinks the over-the-counter stuff is fine. He thinks the Allegra's been helping and the Nasonex, and so he hasn't even taken for the last week or so, which is uncommon at this time of year.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm thinking just that is just such an involved routine with and the shots. And also, if you start the shots, can you try them 1 year and say, it wasn't that much of a help?
No, that's really, unfortunately, a long-term process, and you're usually talking 2 or 3 years of shots.
Mm-hmm.
What the theory behind allergy shots is that you are stimulating your body to produce antibodies to block the allergic reaction. And that's a very long-term process, so this is not a short fix. And given what you've described in terms of his clinical response, I think I would share your same opinion. It doesn't sound like it's anything that you have to do right now.
Yeah. So if you're making this decision, you're committing for a several year period of time. Then
yes.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right, thank you. We're about our midway point here in this part of Focus 580. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is our guest. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. It's a show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we can take a wide range of questions. I know he'll do his best to respond. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask you about colonoscopy, and particularly because the recommendation is now for people at 50 to have a visual inspection as a way of screening for colon cancer, and that involves sticking something in there with a camera.
Well, the current official recommendations from the American Cancer Society are, in fact, that for men and women age 50 and above, periodically undergo some type of screening for colon cancer. And there is the realization on the part of the Cancer Society that not everyone in the country has access to colonoscopy, nor any inclination toward colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, there is, in their official recommendations, a list of different things that can potentially be done to screen for colon cancer. The simplest one is your doctor sends you home with a little kit to check for blood in the stool. Now, this is not a perfect test. But it is considered one part of an acceptable screening method. An X-ray of your colon can be done. Again, not a perfect test, but again, considered acceptable, especially in low-risk patients. And a low-risk patient is somebody who does not have a family history of colon cancer or colon polyps. The next step is flexible sigmoidoscopy. This is one of those little camera devices that goes up through the colon, but only looks at the lower third of the colon. That's an office procedure, does not require intravenous sedation. And again, for low-risk individuals, since the majority of colon cancers have occurred in the area where the sigmoidoscope can see, is considered, you know, again, acceptable. Now, what's pretty much considered the most complete, most thorough examination of the colon and is definitely recommended for individuals who have a family history of colon polyps and or colon cancer is, in fact, colonoscopy. There's a big prep for that because your colon has to be completely empty for them to be able to see. And because the farther you go up into the colon with an instrument, the more uncomfortable it gets, Generally speaking, intravenous sedation is going to be given as part of this examination. So for most patients, the worst part of the prep, worst part of the whole procedure is, in fact, the prep, because it's going to have to empty out their colon the night before. Hmm. But they're not going to remember the colonoscopy because of the IV medication right. that they get right before it. Hmm. But you do then have to bring a driver to take you home, because of the medication, you're not safe to drive yourself home. And they're basically going to tell you, don't make any big decisions today because you're still under the influence of the medication. So there are a variety of ways in which you can screen for colon problems, all of which are considered acceptable by the Cancer Society. I think their initial thought is do something. Mm-hmm. Okay. And depending on perhaps your initial screening results or perhaps on your family history, something more additional, should be done. Now, the most recent thing, and you may have read about this recently, is the ability of a type of CT scan to create or recreate a three-dimensional picture of your colon. And the hope is that large-scale studies will show this to be as accurate as colonoscopy in identifying polyps. The bad news will be that if, in fact, the CT scan of your colon identifies polyps, then you're going to get a colonoscopy to remove them, because that is the one major advantage of the colonoscopy examination, is that if, in fact, there's a polyp, a little growth in the colon present when they look at it, they can remove it at that time. Mm-hmm. That piece can be then retrieved and sent to the lab. We need to sort of reassure folks that not all polyps are cancerous. In fact, the vast majority of them are not. But there are particular kinds of colon polyps that the pathologist can identify underneath the microscope as being of the type that are, in fact, precancerous. And the whole idea here is that you get them out before they become cancerous. And in that particular sense, this type of screening procedure can actually prevent somebody from getting colon cancer.
Well, that's definitely my reason for asking, was having read some things recently about what is being called virtual colonoscopy.
Correct.
And that this would be a non-invasive procedure, and that it could be, some people think that it might be as good as a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. And because it's not invasive, then maybe more people would be actually willing to
right.
to go and do it.
And that's probably a reasonable thing, because it is not a procedure that requires IV sedation. So that's a plus. And two, it's generally cheaper than the colonoscopy. So mm-hmm. that's going to be a plus for everybody. And when you think about it, the vast majority of people don't have colon polyps. So if, in fact, their virtual colonoscopy, which is the CT scan of the colon we were talking about, is normal, negative, nothing in there, then they don't need to do anything else. And it's really only going to be a small subset of people screened that way who turn out to have a polyp who will then need colonoscopy. Mm.
So do you think, though, that we're moving in that direction so that what the hope would be is that we could do that, would be the basic screening. We do it with a CT scan. Mm-hmm. We get more people screened. And then maybe then again, because we're going to be screening more people, then we're going to catch more people that have it either, right. and get it treated before it gets onto being.
Right. Really and I think there's a very good chance of that occurring. The virtual colonoscopy type X-ray procedure has been done in a limited number of medical facilities around the country as a trial. Those initial trials have, in fact, been very successful in terms of when they correlated the CT findings with colonoscopy findings. They found that the virtual colonoscopy was very accurate and wasn't missing much that was clinically significant. And they are now in the process of trying to set up some large-scale trials to see if they can recreate those results from those earlier, smaller studies. And if, in fact, those turn out to be as good as the initial studies, then I think what the scenario you just described is quite mm-hmm. likely to occur.
Now, there, though, do you have to undergo the same prep that if you were having an...
The colon has to be empty.
Still has to be empty so they can... Okay, so right. that part, you know, you're still going to have to do.
And they are working on trying to make the prep, what's the phrase, kinder and gentler. and it is getting better. And as such, currently, one of the common preps used is simply a fiber-like supplement dumped into a fluid such as Gatorade, and you chug a couple quarts
you just
of that.
Drink a whole bunch of that.
And it runs right on through you. Yeah. But by the time you're done, your colon's empty.
Yeah. All right. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You have some questions for our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. We have a caller here, right here, in Urbana, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is not a pleasant question, but I know there's a certain percentage of bad results on the colonoscopy itself where the colon is perforated. And I was just wondering, how often does that happen? And the second part of it is, how can you find out if your gastrointestinal physician, what his particular results are?
The best way to answer that question is to ask him or her what his statistics are, because that type of information is, in fact, available through the location where he or she practices, in that most perforations of a colon are probably going to end up being hospitalized. A few of those are going to need to go to surgery. And you are quite correct. That is a potential complication of that procedure. If you stick something in someplace, you might poke a hole in it. That actually, statistically, is a very rare, probably less than 1 in 1,000.
You think it's that rare?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very uncommon. But it's you know, not zero. And as we talk in my office, when I talk to patients about even, you know, simple basic procedures, like I do vasectomies in the office. It's an outpatient mm-hmm. procedure. It's local anesthetic. It's kind of like a visit to your dentist. But I tell patients, you know, there are no surgical procedures with a zero complication rate. What I tell them is that there's nothing in life with a zero
right.
complication
yeah.
rate.
Yeah.
But you'd like to make that complication rate as low as you can possibly
well,
make
clearly.
It.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about perhaps virtual colonoscopy is that for all those people who have a negative or normal
right.
colon,
right.
you won't subject them to the possibility of perforating their colon by putting a colonoscope in there.
Right.
So there are potentially some additional benefits to that. But your gastroenterologist who does your colonoscopy has a very easy way of keeping track of how many, you know, complications there have been from his or her procedures, and it's a perfectly valid question
to
ask.
That person, yeah.
You bet.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And other questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you know offhand? You probably don't. Just to say, of all the people who have colonoscopies, how many polyps we? How many people we discover with? Who actually have polyps?
I don't have a good handle on that. It is probably a relatively small number, and then we have to sort of subdivide that to situations where there are, in fact, people who have polyps, but they are of the variety that have no malignant potential.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're really getting down to is the subset of patients who have polyps that have malignant potential. And that's fortunately a relatively small number. It's increased in individuals who have a family history of colon polyps or colon cancer. So those people in particular really probably should get colonoscopy as their screening. Now, somebody who says, gee, there's never been any kind of colon problems in my family whatsoever, the likelihood of polyps is fairly low, but again, not zero. And depending on their conversation with their physician, they may opt to do something that's not as complete as the colonoscopy. And that's kind of a personal decision for people to discuss with mm-hmm. their own physician. I think one of the key things is to make sure that on a regular basis that you follow up and you continue to do the screening. It's important to say, well, gee, I had that done once, you know, 20 years ago. Well, that's no longer valid. You know, things change over time. The reason screening for colon cancer is or can be so effective is the fact that it takes a long time to grow a polyp, and it takes even a lot more time for that polyp to then turn malignant. So instead of saying, you know, this is something that occurs over days or weeks or months, this is literally something that takes years to develop. The problem is that if you wait until you have symptoms, you have a very advanced problem. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea here is to find it before you get to that stage. So some people, you know, use the argument, well, gee, I don't feel bad. Well, I'll tell you right now, your polyp doesn't hurt. Your polyp doesn't cause any problems until it becomes cancerous. Well, that's waiting until it's a little too late.
Yeah. And now what are the recommendations about how frequently the test should be repeated?
Again, it depends on which test you're doing. And it depends on your family history. The stool for occult blood should be done yearly. Flexible sigmoidoscopy or a colon x-ray should be done every 5 years. If you're a low-risk individual and you've had colonoscopy done and it was negative, you can probably go 10 years. If you have a family history of colon polyps or you yourself have had polyps, then they're going to recommend looking at that a little bit more frequently. And it'll simply depend on the size, number, and type of polyps that were found as to how frequently you would then follow up.
Let's talk with another caller in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I recently had my annual physical, and I had a nurse call back and told me that my thyroid stimulating hormone test was slightly elevated at 4.3. And she said that meant I was mildly hypothyroid. That first question is that I thought if something was elevated, it would be hyperthyroid.
This is an extremely common and confusing issue. I want you to think of normally when I explain this in the office, I draw a little diagram. And so I'm going to have you put your little picture of your brain at the top of the page and draw an arrow down to your thyroid. And then I'm going to have you draw a little arrow from the thyroid that circles all the way back up to the brain. And in that little arrow that circles back up, we're going to put a T there for thyroid hormone. The way in which your brain and your thyroid function is that your brain normally secretes a substance called thyroid-stimulating hormone, and it tells the thyroid to produce more thyroid hormone, which then gets secreted into the bloodstream and then gets carried back to the brain. And the brain basically registers how much thyroid hormone is present and decides, is that enough or not? If it decides that that's not enough, the next logical step is that it produces more thyroid-stimulating hormone in an attempt to stimulate the thyroid to produce more thyroid hormone. So, in fact, if the brain is unhappy with a low level of thyroid hormone in the bloodstream, your TSH is going to go up.
I see.
Okay? The way to think about this particular, this is called a negative feedback loop. Think about your thermostat in your house. There's an optimal temperature that you want it to be, and you set it where it's supposed to be. And then air circulates back around through the house, but eventually comes back to the thermostat, and it registers, is this hot enough, is this cold enough? And then it kicks on or off the furnace or the air conditioner, whatever you're running that particular season, to adjust. And that's kind of what your brain does with TSH. It's turning on and off your thyroid based on what's circulating back to it.
Now, the thyroid-stimulating hormone, at 4.3
is very minimally elevated. The depending on the lab, the upper limit of normal is usually about 4.
Oh, I saw on the web where it was 4.5, but...
It depends on the lab.
Okay, now the last question is, what's the symptoms of this? What sorts of symptoms, if I don't deal with it, what sort of things?
In all likelihood, with a TSH of 4.3, you don't have any symptoms at all.
Okay.
What I would probably suggest, if you need to look into this a little further, the amount of thyroid hormone circulating in your bloodstream can at least be estimated by drawing another blood test called a T4.
T4?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that is probably going to be a little bit more useful in interpreting your TSH results, because it is not uncommon to catch somebody at a point where the brain was just simply doing its normal job of regulating what your thyroid hormone production is. And in many instances, you check your TSH 6 months from now, and it's normal.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, if somebody has an elevated TSH and a low T4, a T4 below the lower limit of normal, then in fact they probably are mildly hypothyroid.
So you would recommend that I contact my doctor and ask for a T4 test?
I think that will give you the additional information that you need to interpret this one very mild abnormality. Yes.
They also indicated that levothyroxine would be needed, and that would be something one would have to take for sort of the rest of one's life.
Levothyroxine is thyroid hormone.
Yeah.
If you get to a point where your thyroid, for whatever reason, can't produce it, you simply need to replace it. And fortunately, there's a little pill that you can take on a daily basis to replace that.
And the symptoms of hypothyroidism are what?
If you are significantly hypothyroid, meaning that you usually have a markedly elevated TSH and a very low T4, you're going to feel tired, you're going to feel cold, you're going to have problems with constipation, you're going to have problems with very dry skin, thick hair, low blood pressure, slow pulse. People usually then feel quite fatigued. Thyroid hormone has a major role in regulating our metabolism, and consequently you don't burn calories very much, and people will also then tend to gain weight, even though they say, well, gee, I'm not doing anything different in terms of my diet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very good. Other questions again? Welcome. We have about 5 minutes left with Dr. Jeff Swearingen, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask about something. This is not real serious, but there are, over-the-counter, there are a variety of products that are sold that are intended to do some kind of pain relief, and they work by having you rub them on your skin. Now, it's something like Bengay has been around for a long, long time. So as you have muscle ache, the idea is you're supposed to rub it on the place that mm-hmm. hurts. And I'm sure people have seen the commercials for the product that's supposed to relieve headache that way by actually rubbing. Tell me you have not?
I was going to say, I don't think
you
I've
don't
seen
know
that.
About head-on?
I'm afraid I don't.
Apply directly to the forehead? Oh, one of the most annoying ad campaigns.
Really?
In the history of ad campaigns.
I don't watch enough TV.
I guess not. And I have all that one and others, and there are other kinds of things. And I guess I've always wondered. Now, wait a minute, how can such a thing actually work? Just applied to the skin, I can understand, particularly like with Bengay, you do feel, you put it on your skin and it feels hot. Whether that does really has any therapeutic effect
in the sense that you rub something onto the skin that makes it warmer, what you're essentially doing is directing more blood supply to that area. And as such, if in fact that area of the body needs to get a larger blood supply to heal up, then that's probably going to be helpful. But if
I guess what I wonder is, in some cases, what some of these things are doing is that actually they're causing a distraction they're sort of fooling. They're getting you to think about something else.
Well, you can in fact block nerve fibers from conducting pain impulses if in fact they're busy conducting some other sensation. Mm-hmm. So temporary distraction can work. The one topical compound. Well, actually, there are two. You can get local anesthetics that are used topically. That they're prescription, but things mm-hmm. like lidocaine come in a patch form, and you basically numb up the area temporarily. Mm-hmm. But the other substance is it used to be a prescription product, but I believe is now available over the counter. Is called capsaicin, and it's in the ingredient.
That stuff that makes hot chili peppers mm-hmm. hot.
They've actually done some studies where it does seem to alter chemically in the skin a substance that is in fact associated with the transmission of painful impulses. So there is at least some biochemistry for at least some of the topical products. Mm-hmm. But some of the other ones, I'm not, I guess personally, not that aware of how effective they really are.
Okay.
Or why.
Okay. Well, let's get into callers here while we still have time. Charleston, line
Hi.
One. Hi.
I have a question. I have heard that pomegranate juice is about the best thing you can consume. What are the benefits of it?
I guess I haven't heard that, so I don't really know.
Oh.
why is pomegranate juice the best thing you can consume?
I mean, what have you heard about pomegranate? What is it supposed to be?
I've heard, I'm not really sure. I heard, I don't know if you watched Dr. Oz on Oprah, but he said just it's just so good for you. Maybe, and so I wanted to know from a doctor, what is it about it that is good for you?
I'm afraid you've caught me totally off guard. I'm not aware of any particular medical benefits of pomegranate juice.
I guess that's the best we can do.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. We'll go on here to, I hope the caller won't mind if we go on to another caller here. We'll go to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello. Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a new diabetic, and I was told to watch my carbohydrate, but I don't know how many I should watch. What should I have a day?
That is simply based on your physical size and your activity level. But as a new diabetic, have you met yet with either a diabetes nurse educator or a dietitian?
Yes, and they told me that that's all they said. They didn't give me a number.
Okay, well, you should be able to get not only a number, but a listing of different foods and their carbohydrate content with the idea that you would like to try and limit your total carbohydrate intake to a particular value. And if you didn't get a certain number from them, I would give them a call back because that's part of the educational process here. And it's important that you understand that.
Yes. I would think so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're coming down here. We're pretty much at the end. Now, I'm looking at some stuff, just to go back to pomegranate juice, I'm looking at some stuff here, and apparently it looks like pomegranate juice is very high in antioxidants. So
okay.
That would be why it would have some benefit.
Okay.
Just general, what's the deal on antioxidants, just generally?
Substances in our body that cause oxidation cause breakdown in some of the chemical processes that are a normal part of our functioning. So too much of those oxidizing properties in our system cause basically our normal physiology to not function well. And the hope is that by consuming foods that have more antioxidant properties, we will physiologically function better longer.
Okay. Well, people can look into that then. I guess that would be not the only thing. I'm sure that there are a number of other things that are supposed to be good and to have antioxidants. So I guess it does seem to be there is good reason to believe that modification of diet, either trying to have more of certain things or less of other things, mm-hmm. does indeed have measurable health benefits.
Well, when it comes to things like cholesterol, blood sugar, Weight in general, yes, diet and exercise both play a profound role in an individual's health.
Yeah. Okay. So any last thing you might want to leave with the, other than, I guess, again, reminding people that probably the flu shot
yes,
time will be
the end of October. Going forward into the end of the year. I really think it's important that people get their flu shots if they're in the appropriate category. And for the folks over 65, they should also double-check and see if they need their pneumonia vaccination.
And that is the thing that you just generally, you're going to just get that once?
Once after the age of 65.
It could provide you with lifelong.
Yes, occasionally in susceptible individuals, there are some recommendations to boost it, but we like to make sure that they at least get that one after 65.
All right. Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic, and he is with us every other month for this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor.